Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined on the show by David Brooks. Now, here on Final Draft, we enjoy books, writing, and literary culture. Each week, Final Draft broadcasts from the studios of 2SER in Sydney, and we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to the established, the classics, the ones you know and love. These conversations look into the issues that drive the author's storytelling as a way to help you discover more from the books you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging these are unceded lands and the treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Now, today I am joined by poet, academic and writer David Brooks. It is really fabulous to have David joining me. His new collection is called The Other Side of Daylight. And in this wide-ranging interview, David is going to read to us from the collection, an absolute treat. We are going to talk about what has inspired his career, what has inspired the new poems, and we're especially going to look at our connection to our lives with and our obligation to non-human animals, to the way that we, you know, so often as people, we want to exceptionalize ourselves, but yet we really need to live in harmony. And David brings this so beautifully to the fore in his poetry. Please join me as we discover David Brooks, The Other Side of Daylight. It is a pleasure to be welcoming to the show David Brooks. David is an academic, a fiction writer, and a poet. There is so much more to say about David, but I am actually hoping that rather than a lengthy introduction, we might get to know him a little better in a discussion of his new poetry collection, The Other Side of Daylight. David, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
About now, I would give a pithy synopsis, a plot run through, some way to give the reader a sense of what we're about to be discussing, but I don't think that's going to work right now. And so where do we start? Well, I've drawn some ideas from your poems for my questions, but perhaps it would be better to begin. Can I invite you to read from the collection?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem that is kind of atypical of the collection, because I think if our conversation gets going, it may not open the opportunity to read it otherwise, but every now and then you feel like you've nailed something with a poem. And this poem was a gift to me as I stood before an audience at a literary festival and looked at the spare seating and the bored look of the audience before I was introduced, before I even started. And I thought that they've come for a place because they don't know where else to go. They've come because they are tired and they want to sit down. They've come because they want to have their lunch and just quietly listen to something they probably won't understand anyway. We had about three or four very, very good poets at the time ready to read to them, international poets and so forth. I won't say where the festival was, but it was in Europe. And it gave me an idea for a poem. And it was one of those times when the lightning strikes, as it were. You get an idea that you just have to do something with. In my first conception, it was such a shining, perfect poem that it took me a long, long time to get anything that actually resembled on paper the poem I had in my head. It's called Farewell to the Long Sad Party. It takes its title partly from a poem by Mark Strand, the American poet who was, I think, North American, the U.S. poet laureate for a while, and was a good friend of mine and was a very, very wonderful and generous person. And he had a poem called The Long Sad Party. So I borrowed that for my title. The long sad party is ending. No one is listening to the poets or spending any time with the philosopher. No one is trying to understand the lyrics of the gypsy band. The long sad party is ending. No one is visiting the terrace gallery to see the famous painter's pictures of apocalypse. No one is reading the novelist. The long, sad party is ending as it has always done. The dancers on the balcony hold one another and move gently, then turn away. The voices of the singers drift along the corridors. The golden wine is poured and poured again. Someone murmurs something about a morning train. Outside, on the darkened lawn, under the last whisper of the midnight moon, a woman turns to her lover. She opens her mouth to her, and they fall and fall.
Thank you, David. This was actually a poem from the collection that had struck me, and I had a half-formed idea that never became a question in my notes. But one thing that I really grabbed me about this, and my response to it was something of, I guess, in a world where it seems so apparent that there are so many things that require action, we often fail to engage with ideas that things like art, things like poetry, things like music become entertainments and distraction, but we don't actually sit down with them. We don't allow them to make us feel uncomfortable and then deal with those ideas. So it was tremendous to hear that sort of gestation of a bored audience perhaps looking for a reprieve or a distraction as being part of its genesis.
I think that one of the things I do try to deal with, or that I've tried to deal with a lot and comes to a new phase in this collection, is how to use the power of poetry for the purposes I now want to use it. You know, I've written increasingly for 10 years now, 12 years, something like that, increasingly for animals and for animal advocacy. And animal advocacy has become more and more a central focus of my life in general. And I live with rescued sheep and so forth. And it seems to me that this has become a kind of mission, and that in a way, and I've thought about this as I've prepared this collection, because it's a new and selected poems. And so it's a collection of my work from the last 45 years, in addition to the new poem section, which is, you know, 48 poems that have never been published before or never been collected before. And it seems to me more and more clear, my first 30 years of writing, as it were, writing poetry, have been a kind of training for what I'm now trying to do with it, which is to bring it to the aid of the other creatures, the non-human creatures that I care about, and whose lives I'm trying to advocate for. So it's rather important to engage an audience. It's a kind of futile if I don't. And so what I've been trying to work out is how you conduct your poetry as animal advocacy to its most effective, in its most effective form. I mean, how do you make it effective? I have looked around over the last 10 or 15 years for other people, you know, great poets, great contemporary poets, who could help me work out how to write about animals and how to conduct animal advocacy in poetry. And there's really very little. I mean, very, very few people spring to mind. I could name one or two in Australia who've been inspirational to me one way or another, but it seems that it really one's on one's own trying to work out this problem. So one of the things I'm very pleased about with this collection is at last it's getting very, very good responses from those who've read it so far, from publishing people and so forth, and a few people have helped me with the manuscript, as poetry, so that they're not saying, oh, this is, yes, it's very, very good about animals, blah, 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 and then stepping away because they're not really interested, you know. So something has worked to keep their interest, despite the fact that they may not be very comfortable with the subject matter, because the subject matter can get confronting. The animals about us are suffering terribly, and I'm not going to write poems that pretend otherwise. And therefore, I have to tell the truth about the situation and about what we are doing to the animals around us. But I've got to actually manage to present it in some way that anyway has been the endeavor. And if there's an achievement in these poems that I haven't manifest previously, I think it's in getting a little bit better at doing that. The signs are that it's starting to work. And the strength of what I've got to do is maintain the strength of the poetry as poetry. Improve that to the point where it then carries material that people might not otherwise want to confront.
It strikes me through the collection that perhaps you found your muse all around you, and some of your comments there I want to draw out on, but I think perhaps a good place to begin is one of my favorite poems from the collection, which is An Invasion of Clouds. There was something about that lanolin-scented intrusion to your literary ruminations. It was wonderfully visceral and also delightfully cheeky. You've mentioned your sheep. I was really hoping you could tell me a little bit more about how they invade your writing.
There's a wonderful poet here in the Blue Mountains, other than myself, a dear friend of mine, and someone who, you know, in various discussions about who the coming poet laureate should be, whose case I argue strongly. His name is John Watson, and he refers to my sheep friends as my co-authors. I think he's actually got a point there. I mean, the door is open to them. They are by my philosophical conviction, they are welcome to interrupt at any point, and they often do interrupt me. And in a way, the door that they come to and bash on because they want some peanuts or whatever becomes kind of threshold intellectually and emotionally, in ways that do mean that they are opening the poetry, they are opening the writing. I cannot write anything at this desk that is not subject to their interruption, to their reminders of their condition and their being and their needs, etc. So there is a sense in which that situation that is presented, as you say, lightly and amusingly in that poem, and I probably should read that poem so that the audience knows what we're talking about, actually extrapolates into something that almost means that they're part of the poetics at issue. I'm going to read that poem, if I may, because
please do, and then I have this. As I said, this is my favorite poem of the collection. I have at least a follow up question about it, because I was so transfixed by the thought of your sheep, and I'm happy to. I hope our conversation is not limited to them, but I wouldn't be upset if it was.
Yeah, well, we'll try to get beyond them, but in fact, they've already entered it and illustrated the very point that we were making. An invasion of clouds. My study has just been invaded by clouds, each smelling vaguely of lanolin and urine, soft-eyed, wet-nosed, curious-tongued, come to inspect my books and papers like tax collectors for the invisible or auditors from the ineffable earth, trying to determine how I waste my time. Their leader, the unicorn, wants to taste the volume of poems in my lap while another makes for the unfiled bills. The third stares at the ancient aquatint of my great-grandmother in her wedding dress, and the fourth, the black one, turning his back, slowly and sensually rubs his behind on the literary theory section of the bookshelf. Following the others out, he pauses at the doorframe for a final scratch, then pees with pleasure on the just-washed floor.
Tremendous.
I could beam the computer camera around and show the room, but one of the things you'd find, you'd see if I did that, is the mop by the door, because this is quite a common occurrence. Every now and then one of them, in their enthusiasm, will actually push through. And the first thing that they do when they get into the room is to pee on the floor. This is because they are marking it as part of their favorite territory. For example, if John Watson comes to visit me and we have a conversation about poetry that takes an hour in the late afternoon, it's very likely that either just before I leave the writing room that afternoon or when I come down the next morning, one of the sheep will be there wanting to check out the room and make sure it hasn't been tainted by the by a visitor, and to check that they don't need to leave a nice fresh mark to efface the presence of that visitor. So
It's such a wonderfully vivid poem. And if you'll indulge me, because I have been very curious, particularly about the fourth, the black one, slowly and sensually rubbing his behind on the literary theory section, is he critic or philistine? I can't help but think that T.S. Eliot wouldn't mind that.
Some of the people on the literary theory show probably wouldn't mind that, and Eliot's there on the shelf, but I think he was rubbing his bum on the Derrida section. I won't go into that anymore, but one of the things that helped me bridge the territory from Professor of Australian Literature, Associate Professor of Australian Literature and long-term teacher at the University of Sydney, and so helped me bridge the territory into this new life I've had. And thank goodness I've had it. It started to make sense of a lot of things that, you know, that were starting to lose the sense. As I was leaving the department, one of the things I did find myself doing for the first few years was revisiting some of the literary theory that I had been expounding for a decade or two or three before that, trying to find a space for the animal, trying to find a way of thinking about animals. Eventually I did kind of do what Jason did, Jason being the name of the black sheep, and I haven't revisited and I don't revisit that shelf very much. But and that is because I think the space of the animal is not something to be that needs to be approached through literary theory or through philosophy. I think it's far more important than that. That's an outrageous thing to say, I know, and it'll probably get me deeply in trouble at some point, but I think I'm prepared to face it.
Perhaps...
I was
just going to say, perhaps then, David, a step on that journey for us as readers and those who are about to enjoy your poetry, I wanted to draw on the parable of the tins, where in an inner urban backyard, a reader follows a rogue footnote through the side passage to discover a universe I'd have said I'd always known about, but would, as usual, have been lying. This poem spoke to me like this incredible power of noticing, and as soon as we notice, we can't unsee the world that perhaps we would say we knew was there, but had never drawn our attention to. Can you tell me about this power of noticing that I felt infused through the collection?
Yes, I can. It's something that I very much appreciate that question, because that question is, it's very perceptive. It's at the heart of my writing life. I have here in the writing room, in my computer, a kind of diary of this room and this place that I can access visually through the windows, and that comes into the room and so forth. It is, in one sense, the least consequential kind of writing I could ever have conceived of doing. And yet it's governed by a basic principle, which is turning on its head the normal processes and shapes of attention, of concentration, etc. So I will come down to the writing room on a good day when my mind is working, and the first thing I will do, because I'm challenged by a few other things like multiple sclerosis and all that sort of shit, one of the first things I will do when I get to the room is open that file and sit down and write about nothing. If the day is full of nothing, if the day before is full of nothing, I will write about nothing, and nothing will open up into something I was not prepared to go into before I sat down, it sounds like a Buddhist thing. It sounds like a Zen thing. In a way it is, but I don't need Buddhism. I don't need Zen. I'm not interested in them. It's just coincidence that some of the things that they say happen to be things that I've discovered work for me to keep my attention going. So someone, I do have this, the sheep coming to the door are part of it. If the sheep come to my door and I won't open the door because I'm too busy writing, I am committing a stupidity. I would say a sin. It's not a sin. I don't know about that sort of stuff, but it is a stupid thing to say what I'm writing about is more important than opening that door and comforting that sheep than off or in just attending to that sheep's needs one way or another. And it's not just sheep. Other creatures have watched the sheep come to the door, and now other creatures come to the door. I have magpies who come to the door and knock like the sheep do, and so forth. And ducks who wander by and are very, very curious, want to introduce their children to me and stuff like that. Mm. So attention is very important, but the basic principle is turn your normal behavior on its head. Mm. If I find myself anxious to come down because there's something I really want to write, I really want to put it down, and I pass the sheep, it's almost a case of, okay, because I want this, I must do that. Mm. I must stop. I must collect other beings and their requirements, their needs, their being into mine before I go further. Mm-hmm. Heavy, I suppose. I don't mean it to be heavy, because in fact what I'm talking about is something that's very light.
Mm. As an aside, David, I want to come back to the collection in a second, but you mentioned the Magpies there, and I couldn't help but think, like, what a wonderful season it has been for the birds, the fledglings. We've had a family of magpies. Like, dear listener, David and I have realized we don't live terribly far away from each other, and so he and I probably see some of the same birds. And a family of magpies, two parents, two children, that have been, they alternate between our front yard and our backyard searching for their meals, and it's just tremendous to just watch them, to enjoy their calls, their talking, to watch the babies grow into adults. And it's just been a wonderful season for that. And I that was drawn immediately to mind as you were describing there.
It's been a beautiful season for the birds generally. I've noticed that birds and their children are I've seen some birds come back this year that I haven't seen for quite a while. And and one of the other reasons why I keep this diary of the room and of the place is just because so many things like that happen, and I want to be able to have a searchable document over the years, so I can go back very quickly and find out when I last saw a male bowerbird in the vegetable garden or something of that kind. You know, we've got a whole bunch of bowerbirds in the vegetable garden this year, enjoying the tomato crop. So.
we've had a male just the other day, and have not seen a male around here. We had one in another house that we lived that actually had a bower very close by. But yeah, we saw our first male.
Yeah, well, it's been that kind of year. There've been a lot of black cockatoos. I see them flying overhead every single day, and several other birds. I think the something in the atmosphere is just right. Something in the balance of the warm and cold days, and dry and the wet. But and some recovery from the. Some stage of recovery from those horrible fires.
Absolutely. Well, welcome to Bird Watching Hour with Andrew and David. We're interrupting our regular scheduled programming on Final Draft.
Our regular sheep program.
this part of the conversation brings me to, I guess, what I might call the oft-invoked distinction between human and non-human animals. And in the collection, I found in Passports, you illustrate the vagaries of those terms and how they can be used to commodify or to protect. I also found in Pig, you challenge us with the idea that our failure of knowing of, I guess, the non-human animal's soul and spirit is perhaps just a failure of our imagination. So I wanted to invite you, what would you like to say about these distinctions as we make, I guess, as part of what I'm going to call our Anthropocene state of mind?
Well, I think that, one wants to make points that might be useful to listeners or whatever. And one of the things I would say is that we are so deeply trained by the culture, so deeply ingrained by, you know, thousands of years of abuse of animals and so forth, that we should be prepared to and be prepared to go against our better in what we think are our better instincts in our relations with animals and with non-human animals, and overcome the embarrassments that we might have been trained to feel about certain responses to them. It's part of that whole process that I've been talking about of turning things on their heads. We should be prepared to turn our relationships with animals to a certain extent on their heads. Be prepared to think that our automatic assumptions about them are very likely wrong, that our suspicions that they might be feeling this or that or the other are not anthropocentrism. They're not anthropomorphizing. They are the beginnings of a kind of perception. I think that anthropomorphizing has a very, very bad name, and it's been a principle of science that one doesn't go anywhere near the emotions of animals, that there's no way of knowing what the animal mind thinks, there's no way of knowing what the animal heart feels, etc. And I think we should just be prepared to open the conversation and to overcome anything that seems like a barrier to the animals, the non-human animals around us. So that I've thought about this in terms of conversation. You know, I feel that I have conversations with my sheep friends, for example. I think the way to begin overcoming the problem that they do most of their communication through eyes and through breath and things that we can't, I mean, they're not vocal, not very vocal. We should be prepared to conduct conversations with them regardless. Mm. And we should begin with our imagined, with our imaginations as far as their responses go, because it may feel stupid, it may feel crazy, it may feel totally presumptuous, but unless we're prepared to do it and to think about it, we're not going to get anywhere. It's the way we begin to think about it. If we feel silly having conversations, imaginary conversations with the animals around us, that very feeling of silliness is something that's been in, it's part of our indoctrination.
At the risk of another digression, David, it's probably important to, we talked off air about how I at least studied at Sydney University. I studied English literature while you were there. But then going on, of course, if only every English graduate walked into a job that was immediately related to that field, it would be a better world. But I went on, I studied speech pathology. I'm a speech pathologist now. So everything you just said there resonated incredibly with me, because a big part of the philosophy of what I do is that we must look at what I call in the profession multimodal communication, the idea that we privilege verbal communication, the idea that words contain all the meaning that we could ever want, is ridiculous. We intrinsically understand a person's facial expression or even a person's mood when they walk into a room, and the idea that we can't get that from non-human animals is, again, we're lying to ourselves. But of course, a part of this and a part of what I see in the collection is that it is very hard to subjugate, it is very hard to abuse, it's very hard to eat someone that you've had a conversation with.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I think we're not straying away from the collection. I mean, the book itself of the new and selected poems, I mean, there's the new poems, the section, the new poem section is called The Peanut Vendor for obvious reasons. That is, I feel like I am a peanut vendor. I give peanuts to the sheep when they come for them. The sheep can't get at the peanuts that fall into the cracks on the little bridge outside my writing room door. But that's fine, because the magpies can come in, and with their beaks, they can liberate those peanuts. So they stand around waiting for the sheep to go, and then they come in and clean out those ones. And then the peanuts that go down through the cracks are picked up by the cabin rat, who's a close friend. We talk to each other daily through the wall. You know, he taps and I tap. So the new poems are called The Peanut Vendor, but the book overall is called The Other Side of Daylight. And it's called that because of a poem in the new section that I wrote about, well, I wrote during the COVID isolation period. One of the wonderful things that happened in that period, I mean, a lot of very unpleasant things happened in that period. The isolation was very, very difficult for many, many, many people. But we also had stories of emus appearing in the streets and deer appearing in European villages and so forth, coming out of the forest, animals coming out of the forest and wandering through the towns. It was happening here in Australia. People were astonished at how many stars they could see because the pollution was reduced substantially because a lot of the factories had closed and so forth. And it's as if we were beginning to see the other side of daylight. We were beginning to see the other side of the world that we lived in. And another side. I started to list some of these things in a poem and to say, well, isn't it wonderful that we're not even allowed to touch anymore? So we yearn for touch. And so touch has returned as a kind of intense form of intimacy and transgression and so forth. A lot of emotions have come back. A lot of things that we kind of started to take for granted and not granted anymore, and so forth. Another side of daylight was appearing, and yet, even as I wrote that poem, I thought, "Well, wait a minute. This is what poetry has always done. It's always tried to do is to remind people of the other side of their daylight, the other side of." You know, to open up the cracks, show the darkness and the joy and the transgression in the ordinary and so forth. And this is immediately pertinent to that other concern of the collection, the new collection, but my writing for the last 10 years, a lot longer than that in some ways, that poetry enables us to approach the animal, the non-human animal. It may be, it is the one form of communication that we can hope allows more space for the non-human animal, and that it might be the right medium with which to try to represent that non-human animal, and to kind of allow it breathing space in this terribly overwhelming, confining weight of the human. Because it is a mode of speaking in, I was going to say it with a kind of forked tongue, but what I actually mean is, it's a way of communicating some very specific things, but leaving the doors open through metaphor, through that just fundamental assumption that we have when we read a poem, that it means something other than it says. Well, I actually mean very specifically what I say in my poems. I don't write poems to play games with, you know, to make the poem a kind of puzzle or whatever, to make it a challenge to work out what the poem is really about. What I say and what the poem is about is what it's saying. But that said, because it's poetry, it's suggesting all sorts of other things. It's leaving doors open for all sorts of other things. Just by the nature of the music that is woven through the poem, by our automatic assumption that it does mean something other than what it said.
David, might this be an opportune moment to invite you to read again from the collection?
Sure. I'm trying to think of... I'd like to read a poem that I it's called One Too Many Mornings. Yep. It's an illustration of one of the modes of writing about the non-human animal. It gets its title from, there are so many wonderful poem titles in contemporary music, or reasonably in music generally, in pop music and folk music and so forth. And One Too Many Mornings is, of course, the title of a Bob Dylan song, but it's such a great title. I thought, okay. Great poet Steel. One too many mornings. I don't remember what it was. I guess just one too many mornings reading an item in the early news telling of yet another skirmish or outright assault in the endless war. An unknown killer scattering cubes of poisoned meat in a local park. A new target set for the killing, for the culling of roos. Another ship leaving Fremantle with 70,000 sheep aboard, destined for eventual slaughter. But in exasperation, writing to a friend, I'd mentioned the Auschwitz of the animals, only to receive a leaden reprimand. How can you compare, she asked, the suffering of animals with the suffering of humans? I've considered this carefully and ironically have come to think she may be right. There's the Auschwitz of humans, one of the lowest episodes in the long and fettered history of our race. And there are these other ordinary things with no particular name or place. These natural daily things we do, the wrenching of children from their mothers, the stealing of milk to feed the children of others, the maceration of infants or severing of body parts alive, the trucking of countless creatures to their deaths, over no stock race, no paddock gate, no sty, that indefensible lie, Arbeit macht frei. I hope that's not too heavy, but no, I'm lying. I hope it's heavy. It's one of the challenges of writing about animals, non-human animals, to do it in... to increase your repertoire of techniques so that you're not writing every poem like that. Mm. You're not writing every poem as an offensive condemnation of human behavior, you know, because that's going to bore the hell out of readers. It's going to put readers off. It's going to fail to do what you want the poetry to do. So there is a place for poems like that. And I hope there aren't too many poems like that in this new collection. But there is also a place for poems like The Invasion of Clouds, and the joy and lightness of that, and the irony and the fun of that, and the deep affection. I think that the affection comes through both ways, you know, in a poem like that.
I personally think there's a certain enjoyment to getting knocked on your ass every now and again by a set of ideas. The discomfort comes from, I think, the resonance from the when we read that we see elements of ourselves. Like I hear you read that poem, and I think of you know the export livestock industry that's only, you know, a week or two ago saw how many thousands of sheep. But I also think about in our own backyard, David, like, I'm not sure if you've had the pink tags from council, but when the, you know, clearing the weeds and the challenge of how is that done effectively and when plants get poisoned and how that might affect the wildlife. But of course, the full circle of that is these are introduced species and the necessity of it all comes back to, I guess, that human hand in all of this. And if that is confronting, well, that's confronting.
Bless you. I'm going to read another poem because you just mentioned the council. Lament for field mice. I believe in no deity, and the religion I was born into is dangerous and hollow as a drum. But I won't accept that these great trees I stand among are not the volutes and capitals of a vast, inconsecrant cathedral, or that Henry, the used-to-be ram, is not high priest. The ducks and cockatoos and currawong, apostles and prophets of a different sky. The rats and field mice the local council has just poisoned, who bring me whispers as they passed. Mystics and hapless seraphim now twisting in agony in the summer grass. That poem's called Lament for Field Mice. And every word of it is true. No point in writing poems about things that are not true when there's so much truth that has to be known and seen and understood. I have mentioned already in this conversation the cabin rat who comes along and helps clean up the last of the peanuts and so forth, with whom I have conversations daily, as I said. It's heartbreaking to walk out after the council has sprayed poison along the road outside and other places, to find the cabin rat 3 meters from the cabin dying in the grass. Mm. These are friends. No, these are it's true to say that. These are friends, these are fellow creatures. They have been living on this property, for example, for perhaps hundreds of generations. They have a deep, deep knowledge of it, a deep right to be here, like the ducks, like the magpies, like the lizards in the swamp and so forth. And yet we do such damage to them daily.
The collection is incredible, David. And I know you've a couple of times you've mentioned the heaviness of it, and I think it's incredibly important to sit with that heaviness. I've had an enormous pleasure in reading it, but a part of that pleasure is the vacillations between, you know, incredible moment. I can't not come back to Invasion of Clouds. It was one of my favorite, but it helped me through reading so many of the other poems that I had to sit with. You have to sit with your discomfort. And I hope there is a temptation, I think, as, you know, you and I, as we sit right now, we've been chatting for about an hour. And to want to, I guess, shoehorn in some sort of happy ending even to a conversation. But I think that would be very unnatural. And I think the things that we've just discussed are important to just sit with and resonate with. But I say that by way of suggesting that all good conversations must come to a close. But I also want to invite you, are there any areas that I haven't touched on in my questions to you about the collection?
No, I'm not conscious of any at this particular point. One of the things about the collection, of course, is that it is a new and selected, and that half of it, more than half of it, as a volume, is poetry from five previous collections. I would invite those who are interested and readers who want to approach it this way to follow the themes we've been talking about the animal, about the non-human animal, and how to write about them, and to see how that develops from where I was 45 years ago, and to see and to enjoy the way in the most recent poetry, there is a kind of grounding that was being searched for through those previous collections. I do feel, when I look back at them, I am pleasantly surprised that I've been writing about non-human animals all the way through, but I think I've come a long way. There was a long way to come, obviously.
I'm conscious. I've focused on the new poems, the poems from the Peanut Vendor. David, when you mentioned that it is a collection that takes in your career, I flicked through the collection. This is not a contrivance. I honestly, just then as you spoke, I flicked through the collection and my eyes lighted on this, and it just jumped out at me. I am the truffler, the finder of diamonds. I am the pearler in shit, such bitter muscle and bone, such sweetness. And I can take that in the context of the poem, but David, is that you? Is that you writing poetry? The truffler, the finder of diamonds?
Yes. That's from a poem called The Swine Flower, which I wrote 40 years ago. I think I wrote it in 1980 or something like that. I hesitated over whether to put it in or not, but yes, I mean, it seems to me that the poet has to. It seemed to me back then that the poet had to open themselves to all forms of experience. Mm. I think I would say about that poem now, it was relying a little uncomfortably on certain assumptions about pigness that I would challenge. Nevertheless,
is the poem Pig then a response to The Swine Flower?
It could be. It could very well be. It's not a conscious response, but yes, interesting to point that that's the sort of thing that you can get when you read a selected poem. There you go. And compare it with the new section. That's exactly the sort of thing that can be done.
We've just kickstarted someone's PhD on your work, David.
Oh, please, no.
I said we were not going to shoehorn unnaturally a happy ending into a conversation that included some challenging elements, but somehow we've gotten a laugh.
Yes.
The Other Side of Daylight is launching at the end of February, and you have some events coming up, which here on 2SER, we would be remiss if we did not mention. 13th of March is the Sydney launch. It's down at Glee Books, and it is going to be launched by Michael Brissenden. You and I are both talking to each other from separate but not terribly separate parts of the Blue Mountains. And the Blue Mountains launch is happening on the 23rd of March at Rosie Ravelston Bookstore. Rosie Ravelston Bookstore is gorgeous. Please, everyone, make the trip. Not that you should avoid Glee Books. It's also gorgeous. But I've got to recommend Rosie Ravelston. David, it has been tremendous to have this conversation.
I've enjoyed it, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me on the Final Draft podcast, and thanks again to David Brooks. David's new poetry collection is called The Other Side of Daylight. Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. You can stay in touch with Final Draft. We are on the socials, and you just look for the handle at FinalDraft2SER. Subscribe in your podcast, though, your podcast app. That is a way to get a new conversation with an Australian author from Final Draft every single week, and bonus episodes in between. My name is Andrew Popel. I am going to be back with more incredible conversations with Australian authors from Final Draft. Till then, though, happy reading. Bye for now.